So, what we were going to do today is continue on, and just wanted to pick up where we left off. I didn't want these two things to be completely separated, because we're talking about salt and light, and they go together. And just to recap, we are in the Sermon on the Mount. We are talking about Jesus' red letters, the words that he actually uttered himself. And the difficult thing about reading Jesus with modern Western eyes is that we don't get his language. His language is so difficult for us because it is so Jewish, it is so Hebrew, it is so giant, it's so paradoxical. You know, he's telling us to gouge out eyes and cut off hands, he's telling us to turn other cheeks and take other mouths, he's telling us that, you know, just because we haven't killed somebody, we're still not safe. If we just think an angry thought in our minds, we're already guilty. He's telling us all these things in this sermon that are so difficult for us to comprehend. And for 2,000 years, the church has struggled with this because it sounds like an impossible standard. What is Jesus asking us to do if they are impossible to hold, impossible for us to live out? And so there's been all these ideas that, well, you know, he's showing us the impossibility of keeping the law, so we're going to be broken across the back of the law. And different theological reasons why Jesus would use language that he's used. But the principle of Occam's razor tells us that the simplest explanation tends to be true. And simply, we just don't understand the Hebrew idiom. We don't understand the language as it was expressed and the worldview in which it entered in the first century in Judea. And once we do that, we understand something much more deeply about what Jesus is trying to say. Absolutely not impossible. Jesus wouldn't play with us that way and ask us to do things that we couldn't do. He is telling us something that is imminently doable for us. But we have to understand what he's talking about. So when he begins the sermon at Matthew 5, he starts off with the Beatitudes, which, as we've said, were descriptions of the finished product. What does it look like to be someone who lives in kingdom? And he gives us all these attributes, and they're beautiful, but they're also paradoxical, because they are not the attributes that we value and revere in our society. We like the go-getter. We one that stands at the top of the heap. We like the beautiful, famous, powerful, rich people. And we celebrate them and we put them on red carpets. And then Jesus is saying, blessed are you when you are humble. Blessed are you when you are meek. Blessed are you when you mourn. He's telling us if we want to be first, we need to be last. If we want to find our life, we need to lose it. All of these things that make absolutely no sense to modern Western ears. But when we start to dig a little deeper, put them into context, there is a picture that is starting to come out of the mist. As we walk down this road with Jesus, we're starting to understand more and more what he's talking about. This kind of person who can see themselves on a level with everybody else, who does not feel that they need to dominate, they don't need to extract their desires out of the hide of another person, that they can just be in the same boat rowing with everyone else, that they can enter into the difficulties and sufferings of another person's life and be moved to action. That kind of person is experiencing a reality right here and right now that includes the presence of God's Spirit in a tenable way, a palpable way, a way that we can feel and touch, a way that lets us know that everything is going to be all right, even when we have no earthly reason to believe so. Even when all the evidence is going the other way, everything is going to be okay. That kind of person experiences something that Jesus calls kingdom. That person experiences something that allows them to finally let go of their fears and to take the risks that true relationship always, always demands. True relationship is a risk. Those of you who have fallen in love and given your heart to somebody, you know what a risk it is. It's a scary thing to do. We would rather keep our defenses and our shields up than truly give our hearts away. But until we do that, we never experience all that love is. Living this way that Jesus is describing for us, learning to value and treasure the attributes of someone who lives in kingdom is the process of letting our fears subside, of realizing we don't have to perform in order to be accepted. We are already accepted. There's nothing we need to do to be any more loved than we already are. We are already loved as much as can possibly be with an infinite and unconditional love. And when we do that, when we start to move into that space, then there's an effect on everyone around us. There's an effect on the people who are close, the people that we pass by in the street. And that effect, Jesus says, is like salt and light. He says, you are the salt of the earth. In fact, let's go ahead and read that right out of your bulletins, if you have them, or up on the screen there. TJ's got to get them up. Matthew 5:13, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. That's what we talked about last week. Now, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Now, the first thing that I want you to notice is this is not a command. Notice that? He's just saying, you are. And the Beatitudes are not a command. Blessed are you when? See, we have this notion that this is all legal, that Jesus is setting out standards in the Sermon on the Mount that we need to adhere to, we need to obey in order for us to be what? To be acceptable enough to get into kingdom. And Jesus is not saying this. It's the primary mistake that makes the Sermon on the Mount not understandable in our culture. If we think it's a command, if we think it's a legal document, we will completely misunderstand, and it won't make any sense. Obviously, thinking a bad thought about someone, an angry thought about something and someone, and killing them are not equivalent. If Jesus is making them equivalent, then there's something else going on here. And we need to listen with Hebrew ears to find out what they are. Jesus is just merely describing in the Beatitudes what this person who lives in kingdom looks like. And now, in salt and light, he is showing us the effect. When you are living in the kingdom, you are the salt of the earth. And we talked about salt last week, and we have to understand the primary place that salt played in the ancient world, a world without refrigeration, a world without antibiotics. And we said salt performed three major functions. It was to preserve life, it was to fertilize life, and it was to vitalize life. It preserved life because without refrigeration, you could use salt to preserve your food. It could fertilize life because in an acid-based soil, you could use salt as a fertilizer to grow your crops. And when you used it on your food, it gave taste, it gave color, it gave vitality to the food. And we, as people, perform the same functions to the people around us, to our families first and those around us, when we are living this way that Jesus is talking about. This way allows us to be preservatives, to be purifiers, to be fertilizers of new life and new possibility, and to vitalize, revitalize everything that's going around us. And now he says you are salt and light. And so we need to think about the light now. What's the light all about? Well, once again, in Western thinking, we take light and dark, and we think of them in a dualistic sense. They are two things that are unalterably opposed and at opposite ends of the spectrum and are constantly in opposition to each other. That's the way we think of light and dark, and we use them as euphemisms for good and evil. So good and evil, light and dark, polar opposites, at the opposite end of a moral scale, of a standard of things that we must do to be either good or evil. And we see them constantly in opposition to each other. But in Hebrew, there is no such distinction. In Hebrew, everything is one thing and not divided into two or more things. That's Greek philosophy that divides things up. In Hebrew thinking, God is one. God is multiple things functioning as one. And good and evil and light and dark are one as well, but there's a continuum here. And I want you to take a look at the little chart that I put into the bulletin, and let's see if we can start to understand the way Hebrews look at things. Because good and evil, Taba and Bisha in Aramaic, literally mean ripe and unripe. Because what is better in an agrarian subsistence-based society where the quality of your crops meant life and death, literally life and death. If you didn't harvest by the end of the last rains in early spring, then you had nothing going for you through summer and through winter. The crops meant everything. To be ripe, to be able to preserve life, was everything to such a culture. And so the highest good for them was something that was ripe, as opposed to something that wasn't ripe. Something that was mature, as opposed to immature. Something that was able to perform to its design specifications, let's say, as opposed to not being able to do so. All of these things were good and evil to such a people, but they saw it as a continuum. Something that was unripe would become ripe in due time. Something that was immature would become mature in due time. You know, an infant, a child who couldn't perform what an adult could perform, was immature until reaching a certain age and then able to do the things that a human being is designed to do. And so there's this continuum between the two. Not a moral valence, but just a passage along a journey. And when you think sometimes that how could God ever love me because of how bad I've been and this trail of wreckage that is behind me, the things that you think about that just make you cringe, remember that God is seeing you on this continuum. You know, you're just on the path to maturity, to ripeness, to tava. And he can see you that way and love you every step along that path. Changes everything about the way we see ourselves, the way that God sees us. And when we read good and evil in the Bible, we can take them off those moral scales, those judgmental scales, and put them into this continuum and realize that's what God is talking about. And then when you move into light and dark, you have Tava and Bisha in a continuous spectrum, and you have light and dark that are now complementary to each other. See, the thing about light is interesting. We think about light being visible light, light that we can see with our eyes in the visible spectrum. But to the Hebrews, light wasn't just what was visible. Light was really the order, the harmony, the straight lines of enlightenment that brought order to the chaos. Remember in Genesis 1? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and his Spirit is hovering over the face of the deep, and then the face of the earth was form without form and was void and was chaotic with all these swirling dark energies. And then at one point God says, "Let there be light." But it's interesting because he doesn't create the sun until the fourth day. And this is the first day. So there's a lot of Darwinians and Big Bang theorists that say, well, you know, obviously this story doesn't make any sense because God says, let there be light on the first day, but he doesn't create the bodies that would give us light until the fourth day. And so this is all messed up, but they're missing the point that when God says, let there be light, what he's really saying is let there be order. Let there be form. Let the chaos be separated. And let the roles be assigned. The word there for created, bara in Aramaic, Bereshit bara Elohim, the first three words of Genesis, bara doesn't mean to create in the way we would think of creating. It means to differentiate. It means to separate. It means to assign roles. So what is God doing? He's differentiating the light from the dark, the order from the chaos. And then there is day and night. And then there is male and female. He's differentiating these things and the water and the land, separating, differentiating, creating the order, everything that is needed to support life as we know it. God said, let there be order, let there be harmony, let there be a structure here that can support life, that can move my purpose forward. And then he created the sun, and then there's visible light. You know, or maybe there was some kind of light. I don't know. But the main point here is God is creating order. As the Hebrews understood light, nura in Aramaic, it's something that is seen. It's a straight line, harmonious kind of movement forward, something with purpose, something with an arrow on it that is directing us in a path. It's ordered, and most importantly, it's usable. It's functional. It can do some work that is beneficial for preserving life. At the opposite end, we have Heshuka, darkness. That is unseen. It's swirling, it's curved. It's like the powerful energies of water and wind that are unpredictable and do not move in straight lines. It's chaotic and it's unusable. It's not something you can grab onto. It's mysterious. It's even mystical. But it's not evil in the way we think of evil. These are necessary and complementary forces. And when you take it down into the idea of day and night, Yama and Layla, now we can see that these forces are alternating. Daytime is a time for Nura. Daytime is a time for moving things forward with purpose, to have a cause and an effect and an agenda, and moving things forward with the straight lines of the sunlight. And then nighttime is a time of repose, the time of assimilation, the time where you just take all these things in. It's a time for dreams. They don't make rational sense. They're not straight lines. They're curved. But they're so important for us to have a balance between the two. You know, if you don't dream within a couple of weeks, you're completely psychotic. We need our dreams. We need our time of repose. We need our time of Heshuka, the time of darkness. And so Hebrew light is not necessarily visible, but it is straight and ordered and usable and functional. It's also illuminating in a spiritual sense, in giving us insight, and it's also comforting. It's comforting to be in the light. It's comforting to see those straight lines and see some sort of path before you, as opposed to the darkness, which is not necessarily blackness either. The darkness can be performed in blazing daylight, because what darkness really is something that is obscure, chaotic, unusable, unfunctioning, mysterious, and frightening. Those curved forces frighten us because we can't figure them out. They don't make rational sense. You know, we can't put a pin through them and put them under glass and know exactly what they do and how they function. But both are absolutely necessary. Absolutely necessary for us to function. Notice that the darkness precedes the light. The darkness is the older of the two. Darkness exists, and then God brings the light, brings the order to it. And it's the same way with us. We start as children not rationally thinking. We start as children in that swirling and more chaotic place. Have you all heard of the id and the ego? You know, Freud's map of the psyche? You know, that id part of our brain, that id part of our mind, I should say, that is a primitive thought and has no sense of time and is all about just base desires without any rational thought. That is the mind of the child. And the ego, the rational thinker, the one who then mediates and starts to add some sort of ethical or moral imperatives, that would be the superego, I suppose, comes later. And the same thing happened with us as a race. So we see in Genesis this Hebrew thought, this idea of moving from the darkness into the light on this continuum and alternating back and forth. And so now we start to understand what light is to the Hebrews. Now we can start to see where Jesus is going with this. And he tells us, you know, you don't put a city on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. And so this idea of a city on the hill, something that is a beacon, it's got sight lines everywhere, and you cannot miss it. And so Jesus is saying, this is the same way when you are lit up from within, when you have gone through this process and become someone who lives in kingdom and has these attributes, you will be lit up from within, and there is nothing you can do to hide that. Your life is your light, and it will be visible to everyone that you come in contact with. This is the effect that you will have on people as you go through life, just doing the things that you do. Even if you don't do anything other than what you normally do, there will be something about you that cannot be hidden, just the way the city on the hill cannot be hidden. It has become who you are, and there's no way that you could be anything else. And then he says, you don't put it under a basket, you know. You put it on a lampstand, so it lights up everyone who's in the house. And even the words there that Jesus used, shiraga, for lamp, also comes from a verb that means to illuminate, to imagine, or to dream. It's more than just physical light Jesus is talking about here. And sata, a basket, is any round enclosure, but it's also a secret place, a veiled place, a shelter. And so it says you don't secrete this off. You don't compartmentalize it and take it away, but you let it shine. Now, as he uses this imagery, to the people that he's talking to, it has a special significance. Because poor people, poor Galileans especially, living in first century Judea and the Galilee, often lived in communal dwellings. There could be a single large room with as many as 50 people living in it. Families, multiple families with all of their children, and of course their animals, and there's everything else that goes with that, all living in a single big room. And what they would do, they would have areas designated for each of the families, and they'd have their own fire, and they'd have their own spot, and their own space, and they'd have their own lampstand to give them light. And they're living this way. Try to even imagine what that would be like, with up to 50 people in one space, dirt floors, no real windows, because in Hebrew custom, the women and the family needed to be secreted off, and so they didn't have windows, or if they did, they were heavily latticed. You know, a latticed, you know, some sort of wooden grid work, so you couldn't really see in, and so it didn't leave much light, let much light into the house, even during the daytime. And so this smoky, smelly environment with all of these animals and everything, you'd bring the animals in at night so they wouldn't freeze, they wouldn't get stolen. So you're imagining this scenario. And now imagine it's nighttime, it's time to go to bed. Each of the families has their lampstand, has their light, and they're doing whatever they do at night, telling stories, you know, talking with each other. As one family retires, they put their lamp out. Now the light from the other families is, of course, bathing them as well. And maybe fights break out because it's like, would you put your light out? I want to go to sleep now. So what you would do, you could veil the light and you could put it behind something so that if you were staying up past the other families, you could still have light, but you wouldn't be bothering anybody else. This is the reality of their lives. And when Jesus speaks about a lampstand giving light to the whole house, they know exactly what he's talking about. All these images come to the fore. Because what if one family runs out of oil? And they don't have a light. But what the next family over can do is push their lampstand so that it can light both of the families. And you can share the light. That's what Jesus is talking about here. If someone has run out of oil and they don't have the light, you don't veil yours and keep your light. Because this is my light. And I'm not going to let you have any unless you pay. You share the light. And this is what Jesus is talking about. We, as people who live in kingdom, are those who can share the light, who can light the dark places of other people's lives when they run out of oil, when they run out of steam, when they're unable to carry the weight anymore. Here we are, lit from within, and we can give that salt and that light, that encouragement, that revitalization that is so needed by so many people. So let your light so shine, as King James would have it. In other words, let your life be your light. And let it always point back to Father, to the values of the Father, to what the Father is all about. Now, how do we do this? You know, this is the question. And I always, when we go through something like this and we go back into the context and it sounds all really interesting and it's a lot of mind candy and it's, oh, this is great. What are you going to do with it, though? What good is it? We're talking about a culture that lived 2,000 years ago and I got my life to live right now. You know, I got my own problems. You know, they had theirs, I got mine. How is this of any use to me? This is the thing that we need to understand. How are we salt and light? By doing good things? By being obedient? By following the law? And Jesus would say, you know, 1,000 times no, that's not what this is all about. You know, this is not a legal document. This is not us just doing something. It's about being something. It's about becoming something. Because before we can do anything in the light, we've got to see the light ourselves. We've got to see the light. We have to have the light become who we are so that we're lit from within. And what we do is just the natural consequence of who we are. And then that light will never be veiled. It will never be put under the basket. So, the next question then is, how do we become the light? How do we do that? Do y'all have someone that you know in your life who seems to always be in chaos? There always seems to be some drama going on in their life. Remember that there's a... This, and I'm really dating myself here. Who is brave enough to raise their hand and say they remember the little Abner cartoons in the Sunday paper? Yeah, Perry? Yeah, okay. Little Abner. Anyway, it was a cartoon that ran for years and years and years, probably decades. But there was a character in it that always had a rain cloud over his head. And he'd walk around with the rain cloud with the rain pouring down on his head wherever he went. Kind of like an Eeyore figure from Winnie the Pooh, if that works better for you. You know, how many of you know someone like this who is always under a cloud, always has drama, always has chaos? You know, is it really that they have some sort of curse on them? Is it really that the rules of the universe just apply differently to them? And so that they always are right in the right place at the right time when the catastrophe happens? You know, no, of course not. The universe doesn't work that way. God doesn't work that way. But I'll tell you what. Sometimes we get so traumatized that we cannot let go of the trauma. Sometimes we can't see another way to live. And sometimes we get so scared because everything that we treasured has and can be taken from us that we cling to the one thing that nobody can take. In other words, we become friends with our misery. We become friends with the chaos. We become friends with the darkness. Because at least it seems like it won't abandon us. Sometimes we get identified by a single point in time, a single traumatic event, and we cannot let go. There was a Star Trek episode years ago, I remember, and the captain encounters this alien race that lived outside of time. They had no concept of time, you know, and they could freely move between past and future and present. And so as he's encountering this race, he's encountering all the different places of his life and the moments of his life and past and future. But he keeps coming back to the most traumatic event, the death of his wife, over and over. He keeps coming back and coming back. Finally, he screams out to these aliens, "Why do you keep taking me here? This is the most, you know, painful moment of my life. Why do you keep bringing me back?" They say, "We're not bringing you back. You're bringing yourself back. Your whole life has become defined by this one event. The death of your wife has defined you. It colors everything that you think and everything that you do and every decision that you make." This happens to us. We are much more shaped and formed by the traumas in our life than the good things that happen to us. And some things are so traumatic, so catastrophizing, that we just can't let go. And we end up hanging on to the chaos. We end up hanging on to this darkness in our lives. How do we get through? How do we break out? How do we go anywhere else? You know, even in John 3:19, just a couple of verses after the famous John 3:16, John is talking about that the light came into the world, but the men love the darkness. Men love the darkness. It's not even that we think we love it. We think we hate it, but we hang on to it. And we don't let it go because it's all we know and we think it's who we are. How do we break through? To me, the first step toward breaking through, obviously, is a desire for something utterly else than whatever it is that you're experiencing. And unfortunately for most of us, that means that the pain of our life, the pain of our chaos and misery, the pain of our darkness, has to get great enough to be greater than the fear of the unknown, the fear of the next thing, the fear of the light. We have grown familiar with, comfortable with, married to the darkness, and now we have a fear of anything else. So when the pain gets greater than the fear, then we finally have a desire that can motivate us, that can move us to the next thing. And then what we need to do is recognize the nature of enlightenment. You know, it's the enlightenment that we say we want. We have to recognize how that really happens. How does that occur? There's an old story of a mule that falls down a well. And all the villagers come around and they're trying to figure out, how in the world are we going to get this mule out? You know, we don't have strong enough ropes. And they finally say, you know what? It's an old mule anyway. And we really needed to fill in this well so nothing else falls in. So they just decide they're just going to shovel in the dirt and bury the old mule and send him off. So they shoveling in the dirt, and the mule is braying and freaking out and screaming in its own mule way. And then after a while, it grows quiet. And they all wonder, what's going on down there? You know, they're still shoveling in the dirt. And they watch. The dirt lands on the mule's back. He shakes it, and it falls off, and he steps up. He shakes it. He steps up. And after a half an afternoon of doing that, the mule gets to the top, climbs out, and walks on his happy way. See, we falling into the bottom of our wells in the darkness of our curved space, we're looking for the straight lines of Nura, the straight lines of enlightenment to be thrown down to us, to pull us out of our wells. We want that. We want that so badly. We want it to be quick. We want it to be straight. We want it to be understandable. And we want it to be immediate. Save me. Take me out. How many of our prayers are, save me, Father. Give me the clarity. Show me the light. Tell me what I must do. We pray this way. We want the straight rays to come down into our darkness. But the problem is our space is curved. Our darkness is not straight. The straight rays cannot penetrate. They get all broken up and shunted off. They don't reach us. And so the way is not to have the light come down to us. The way for us is to come up into the light slowly. I know Frank hates when I say this, but some people call it endarkenment instead of enlightenment. You know, the Texan mind just can't quite comprehend endarkenment. What the heck are you talking about? It is this slowly raising up, layer by layer, insight by insight, that takes us into the light. It's the only way that we get out of curved space into the straight rays of the sun. You know, think about Jesus' teaching. Think about how he taught. He wasn't teaching so much as he was making students ready to see the light at their own time, at their own space, at their own pace. Ask him a straight question. He doesn't give you a straight answer. He asks you another question. He tells you a story. Who is my neighbor? And he tells us the story of the Good Samaritan. Good master, what must I do to obtain eternal life? Why do you call me good? There's only one who is good, and he's your Father in heaven. And he gives us all these incomprehensible backward sayings. You know, he sounds like a Zen master more than any kind of Western pastor, because he understands. Just by the way that you frame the question, just by the way that you are looking for the light, you are doomed not to find it. Unless you can break that line of thinking and you can take the quantum leap over to another place and begin again. So he's there to give you the non sequitur. He's there to break your line of thinking and to move you into a new way, a path that will actually take you where you want to go. That is the process of enlightenment. It doesn't feel like learning in any way we think of learning. It just feels like living your life. Paying attention to the details, being present, allowing another shovelful of dirt to hit you on the head, and instead of crying out and saying, what an insult, to realize the way of things and just let it layer up in your life slowly. I have people ask me all the time, how do I stop these thoughts that I'm thinking? How do I stop the emotions that I'm feeling? And I tell them, you know, it's like urban warfare. It's house by house and block by block. It's moment by moment. If there were one prayer that you could pray, if there was one maxim or principle that I or anybody could give you, don't you think we would have by now? And we'd be all fixed? There is no way to do this. Certain things in life cannot be transferred between humans, between minds, carried by human speech. It doesn't work that way. It must be experienced moment by moment. If you have a trigger, if you have an emotion that keeps coming up and has a predictable response, you make a predictable choice, then the only thing that you can do is to train yourself to become aware of your moments, to see yourself in the moment, being triggered, feeling what you feel, and realizing that when I have trigger X, I always do Y. Today, I'm going to do Z. Today, I'm going to do something else. And in the genius of AA and the 12 steps, you do the opposite thing. Whatever your emotions are telling you to do, if it's depression and all you want to do is crawl up in a fetal position and pull the covers over your head and draw the blinds, you do exactly the opposite. You shower, you shave, you get dressed, and you show up wherever it is you're supposed to show up. If your anger or your jealousy is causing you to lash out or to gossip or to do anything that would tear down the people around you, you do the exact opposite. And you encourage, and you build up, and you kill with kindness. And when anything that you're feeling would cause you to isolate, you simply open up and you drop your shields and you become part of. And every time you do that, every time you can successfully negotiate a change in action, you have an experience that will add another layer to the bottom of your well and lift you up just a little bit higher and higher and higher. Because ultimately what we're driving at is trust. Kingdom is not possible without trust. And the way that you know that you trust something is when you stop worrying about it. You stop thinking about it. You stop planning for it. You know that it's there for you. You trust it. And the trust is what we need to experience. As we come back to this place, to these moments of connection, these moments of opposite action over and over again, what we are experiencing is the presence of our God. The connection that we feel, the sense that everything is going to be okay in a way that we can't imagine, that is our God. That's who He is. He is love and forgiveness and redemption and healing and all those things that we experience in these moments. That is the nature of enlightenment. It's the curved path of endarkenment, and it takes us there, slowly rising up into the light, whether through Jesus' parables and stories that take us into an evocative place where we can understand, or in the moments of our lives, and the two connecting together to give us a new sense of who we are. So the next thing that we always need to do is to practice. We got to practice these moments. There's nothing else that we can do except practice these aware moments, to wake up inside our moments and take another course, which means that we have to be willing to let go of everything that we're clinging to, everything that we're holding on to. If we are loving our misery and clinging to it because it's the one thing that feels familiar, when will we be ready to let it go? When enough moments like these have passed? Whatever the combination of things and the things that in our lives that take us there is just the right amount. We have people who are beating themselves up one side and down the other for the trail of wreckage that they've left behind them. You know, and yes, it's regrettable. And yes, in an ideal and perfect world, it wouldn't exist. But guess what? It's not an ideal and perfect world. And whatever has taken you to the place where you can be the person who wakes up inside your moment and chooses for another, chooses to leave them better than you found them, is just the right history for you to have. It's just what needed to happen in your life to bring you here. And now the resolve comes in to keep coming back here over and over and over again. Because literally what you're doing is remapping your brain. You are creating new habits, new ways of thinking. And while you're doing that physically, the spiritual is happening as well. You're experiencing your God and trusting your God more and more, connecting. And as you do that, and as you realize you are just like everybody else, connected with everybody else, you start to take on those attributes more and more strongly that the Beatitudes were laying out: the humility, the empathy, the sympathy, the relentless drive, the hunger and thirst for those things which are most of God. All of those things slowly become who you are as you rise up from the bottom of your well. And then you become the salt and the light for others to be able to get a taste of what the light looks like properly installed in a human being. And you can be their reflection. What does it mean to glorify God? It means to reflect who He is, to live His values, and to leave people better than you found them at every turn. This is where Jesus is bringing us. This is what this life is all about. It's not complicated. It is so incredibly simple. It comes down to one thing. But it's not easy either. And it's not for the faint-hearted. But if we persevere, if we move down this, we will know a peace that we have not known before. And that's what kingdom feels like. That's what trust feels like. Let's pray. Father, I guess I want to thank you for working so hard to give us an idea of what this is all about. For sending your son who lived it and showed it and left no stone unturned with anyone he was with to try to get across just another shovelful of what it means to live in the awareness of your spirit. So thank you for that, Father. Thank you for our scriptures. Thank you for these incredibly beautiful passages that are showing us the light. Help us to do what we need to do. Help us to let go of the things that we're holding on to and to begin to value the things that you value and let them take us where they will. Father, it's an amazing life. Help us to see it as an adventure and not a burden. Help us to see the unknown as the opportunities for something amazing to happen that we never saw coming, instead of something so frightening that we go back and pull the blinds. Help us to simply enter in, to open up, to drop our shields and just let the moments roll through us and over us and feel the trustworthiness of your spirit. Thank you, Father. We love because you first loved us. In Jesus' name. Amen. Let's all stand.